Campus FM presents A Book, A Thousand Stories. A review of the book, The Hare with Amber Eyes, by Edmond de Waal. Production and presentation, Patricia Salomone. Musical advice by Gerald Fennec, and technical support by Samuel Attard and Carmelo Grech. In our overview of The Hare with Amber Eyes, we have now reached the 23rd chapter, in which the author tells us much about his grandmother Elizabeth von Effrussi, who is the main fount of information for his book and is also his source of inspiration. De Waal's admiration for this modern, intelligent, brave woman, his grandmother, is discernible throughout the chapter. Remember that it was Elizabeth's dream to enter university, and succeed she did, choosing to read philosophy, law and economics. A very Jewish choice, says de Waal. To be an advocate in Vienna meant being an intellectual, and one-third of the law faculty was Jewish. Elizabeth is indeed an intellectual. Intelligent and hard-working, she was, in de Waal's words, a plain, fierce, focused, intellectual 18-year-old. She attended a university, that of Vienna, in the 1920s, which languished in a critical financial situation, but which possessed extraordinary scholarship in economics, physics, philosophy, law, history, and art history. She attended the classes held by the economist Ludwig Mies, who stressed the implausibility of the socialist state. Yet her passion was poetry. She was fascinated by the lyric poetry of Rainer Maria Rilke, the great radical poet of the day. She had been introduced to Rilke by her mother's brother Pips. This saw the beginning of a five-year-long written correspondence between the 20-year-old student from Vienna and the 50-year-old poet who lived in Switzerland.
Widely recognized as one of the most lyrical intense German language poets, Rainer Maria Rilke was unique in his efforts to expand the realm of poetry through new uses of syntax and imagery and in the philosophy that his poems explored. He was seen to express ideas with physical rather than intellectual symbols. While Shakespeare, for example, thought of the non-human world in terms of the human, Rilke thought of the human in terms of the non-human, of what he called Dinge, things. The poet strove throughout his life to reconcile beauty and suffering, life and death, into one philosophy. Rilke, whose full name was René Carl Wilhelm Johann Joseph Maria Rilke, and born in 1875, was the only child of a German-speaking family in Prague, then part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. His father was a retired officer in the Austrian army who worked as a railroad official, his mother a socially ambitious and possessive woman. At age 11, Rilke began his formal schooling at the military boarding academy, but was discharged in 1891 due to health problems, from which he would suffer throughout his life. Back in Prague, where he found out that his parents had divorced in his absence, he began receiving private instructions toward passing the entrance exams for Prague's Charles Ferdinand University. In 1894, his first book of verse, Leben und Lieder, Life and Songs, was published. His opinion was sought after by young writers like Franz Xaver Kappus, who also studied at the Military Academy and was uncertain whether he ought to pursue writing as a career. They engaged in a correspondence in which Rilke advised on how a poet should feel, love, and seek truth in trying to understand and experience the world around him and engage in the world of art. Kappus published these letters under the title Letters to a Young Poet. One can imagine that in a similar way Rilke exchanged advice and ideas with Elisabeth von Effrussi. Rilke's life as a poet was a journey which took him from Prague, amongst others, to Vienna, Munich, Moscow, Worpswede, Paris, and different places in Switzerland. A journey on which he met intellectuals, artists, and the sculptor Clara Westhoff, whom he married in 1901, the same year his daughter Ruth was born. In the last few years of his life, Rilke was inspired by such French poets as Paul Valéry and Jean Cocteau, and wrote most of his last verses in French. Always a sickly man, the poet succumbed to leukemia in 1926 while staying at the Valmont Sanatorium near Lake Geneva. To close this chapter, I wish to quote one of Rilke's famous sayings. Let life happen to you. Believe me, life is in the right, always.
Referring to her fascination with poetry, the poet tells the young law student, "The contrast between your two occupations is positive. The more diverse the life of the mind, the better the chances are that your inspiration will be protected, the inspiration which cannot be predicted, that which is motivated from within." Words these, which all we who belong to the older generation wish to pass on to our young ones, who, unfortunately, often do not listen. Rilke is known for his lyric poems, for those periods of silence when his mental state stood in the way of inspiration, and for his great spurts of restless writing when concluding a great work. "Then you feel a dangerous buoyancy, as if you could float away," he wrote to Elizabeth. Rilke's letters to his young disciple were often lyrical. Allow me to quote a few lines from one of these. "I believe that in Vienna, when the dragging wind is not cutting through you, you can sense the spring. Cities often feel things in anticipation. A paleness in the light, an unexpected softness in the shadows, a gleam in the windows, a slight feeling of embarrassment of being a city. In my own experience, only Paris, and in a naive way, Moscow, absorb the whole nature of the spring into them as if they were a landscape. On his grandmother's death, Dawal inherits her books, and here he finds her notes written alongside the margins. He finds a transcription by her of a poem by Rilke, a photograph of the family sitting room in Kovacek's. He fears that he is becoming sentimental, giving too much importance to things, while his grandmother had very little care for material objects and valued poetry instead. The world of things made lyrical. And it is in a lyrical mood that our author returns with the mind to Emmy's dressing room. Emmy is now in her 40s. Her older children are turning away. The little boy in the nursery complicates things. Social life is now poorer, but her faithful maid Anna is always kept busy. Emmy's changing room, with the fresh posy of flowers from Kovacek's on the Louis XVI desk dressing table, and the black vitrine with the 264 Netsuke fading away into infinity in the beveled mirror backing the green velvet shelves, is no longer the center of life in the palais. The room is now still, of a stillness that the wall likens to Rilke's writing of a vibrating stillness like that of a vitrine. We are now in the mid-20s. To be exact, it is 1924, and Elizabeth receives a doctorate degree from the University of Vienna, and soon after a Rockefeller scholarship to travel to America. She writes about American architecture and idealism, how the ardor and fervor of skyscrapers fit with contemporary philosophy, for a German journal. On returning from the States, she stops in Paris. She is in love with a Dutchman, Hendrik de Waal. Emmy's other older children also leave the Palais and leave Vienna. Beautiful Gisela marries Alfredo Bauer, a Jewish Spanish banker, moving to Madrid in 1925. Soon Spain will not be the best place for a young Jewish couple to bring up their family. Iggy, on graduating from school round the corner in Schottengasse, goes on a motoring tour with his childhood friends, the Gutmanns. Imagine these three rich young men being driven by a chauffeur in a luxury Hispano Suiza, an elephantine car of fabled luxury.
Sentimental baby, I see a tear. Sentimental baby, please tell me dear.
Imagine them, these three young men, wearing motoring coats with goggles over their motoring caps as they ride, car hood lowered, between Vienna and Paris. They take the long way round through Italy's Riviera. The sun family finances are not so rocky, and Iggy is the only male offspring in the whole Efrusi family of bankers. His destiny is made, good or bad as he may be at numbers. He simply has no choice. He goes through a three-year grueling ordeal of studies in finance in Cologne and starts work in a Frankfurt bank. Later on in life, Iggy would say that it was unwise to be a Jewish banker in Germany during the Depression.
Hitler's rise to power in Germany by 1933, not quite unlike Mussolini's in Italy by 1922, must be seen in the light of an unsettled Europe after the First World War. Rather than a war to end wars, the consequences of this cataclysm were immense. It unleashed economic and political instability, which ambitious and ruthless strong leaders intervened to end by assuming power themselves. The worst of these was Adolf Hitler, a failed Austrian artist who fought in the war, became an army propagandist, and joined the German Workers' Party, which he took over and transformed into the National Socialist German Workers' Party. Hitler and his party fed on nationalistic feelings among Germans, who saw the armistice in 1918 as a defeat and a humiliation, resented its war guilt clause, in which Germany was blamed for starting the war, opposed the French-driven reparations as too harsh and unjust. On top of this, there was inflation, unemployment and uncertainty, further fueled by the Wall Street crash in 1929. American attempts to alleviate the situation were unsuccessful, as a demagogic populism intensified, characterized increasingly by street fights, especially between the right-wing and left-wing militants, the former Nazis and the latter communists. Although there were moments when a social democratic communist alliance could have outvoted and possibly defeated the Nazi advance, in Moscow the Comintern was keener to see the Social Democrats defeated, as these were judged to be competitors for a working class base. Hitler always saw violence as a means to an end, and he wrote a supposed autobiography in the mid-1920s, Mein Kampf, mainly in Landsberg prison, after his earlier attempted putsch in Munich, November 1923. Realizing his oratorical powers, playing on popular emotions, including anti-Semitism, he noted that it was by the power of speech that the masses of the people could be moved. The failure of the Munich putsch also convinced him to attain power with the existing machinery, rather than against it. In other words, to use democratic institutions in order to undermine and abolish them. He never accepted the republic set up at Weimar, or indeed the Social Democrats, associated with it. When years later Germany would be losing the Second World War, one largely instigated by his expansionist diktat and racism, rather than cut his losses as President Ebert had tried to do in 1918, he would insist on total war and a fight to the finish. Hitler's rise to power is immersed in intrigue, inter-party deals, duplicity, sustained all the time by recourse to demagogy, social engineering and intimidation, even within his own ranks, subject only to unconditional loyalty to himself. The pure and superior Aryan race would prevail over all comers. The NSDAP's electoral showing in 1930 and even in 1932 led well-placed interlocutors to convince President Hindenburg, a respected but elderly war veteran, to appoint Hitler as chancellor, almost as a safety valve. Although Hindenburg mistrusted him and disapproved of his methods, he was led to believe that Hitler and the Nazis could be controlled. In his book Hitler and the Collapse of Weimar Germany, Martin Brotzat quotes one aide reassuringly telling Hindenburg in 1933 that one would know how to deal with these young chaps, who are basically quite nice. Soon afterwards, the enabling law was passed, whereby the Führer could effectively do what he liked and as he pleased. So he did, including pouring ruin on the whole of Europe and an unprecedented organized mass extermination.
We have now reached the 1930s. These are the years of Adolf Hitler's rise to power, after his appointment to Chancellor in 1933, a month after which thousands are taken to preventive detention, to detention camps on the edge of Bavaria, Dachau. In July 1933, Iggy was expected back in Vienna to take up his position in his father's banking business in the Schottengasse. But Iggy did not turn up. Iggy ran away. In this second half of chapter 23, we are entertained, and I am quite fascinated, following the adventurous life of this young man who chooses to do what is least expected of him. He enters the fashion world, and he does so by starting at the very bottom, working in Paris in a third-rank fashion house, learning how to sketch tea gowns. He spends nights learning how to cut in an atelier, 4 hours sleep on the floor on a friend's apartment, and then coffee and back to drawing. He is poor. On a small pension from his unsympathetic parents, he barely survives in Paris, nourishing his passion for clothes, a passion born and nurtured in his mother's changing room, on the light yellow carpet by the Netsuke vitrine. He learns cutting in a French atelier and, having mastered the art, runs away again, this time to New York. A sort of baptismal crossing from one life to another. A voyage, in some way, to himself. Today we would call it Iggy's coming out. Years later in Tokyo, during his nephew's visits, Iggy could not help smiling while reminiscing about this cathartic period of his life. When in New York, Iggy finds his Eldorado. He drops his first name, Ignatius, but still announces himself as Baron I. Leo Ifrusi. Under this name, he produces fashion design, mostly sophisticated gowns for the smart American women, but also smart accessories shown for the first time in California, belts, bags, ceramic jewelry, and compacts. We are now in the 1930s, in the elegant Art Deco period, but we are also in a very much in-between period of the 20th century, when dark clouds are gathering that would see the Depression in the United States and ugly winds of war fast advancing on the old continent. Still, free of the shackles of duty to his family tradition of banking, free to assert his real nature, Iggy is a happy man, sharing a relationship with the elegant, slim and fair Robin Curtis, who is younger than he and is an antiques dealer. New York was full of newly impoverished Russians, Austrians and Germans escaping Europe, and Iggy, the Waal tells us, was one of the many. In the coming episode, we shall learn how the other members of the Ifrusi family fared in the pre-World War II decade. What were their hopes, their expectations, their aspirations, their delusions? No coachman and horses in the large courtyard, but car and chauffeur behind the large oak door on the Ringstrasse. shall see all this next week. Till then, dear listeners. Sincere thanks to Christoph Vollmann and to Professor Henry Frendo for their valuable contributions.